History.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Moscow. Christopher Halali, research and political analyst out of Vermont. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا إسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza continues for the 144th day, resulting in more loss of Palestinian lives and a trail of destruction. The U.S. president foresees a ceasefire deal in Gaza by next Monday, involving an exchange of 400 Palestinian prisoners for 40 Israeli captives. Also in the headlines, the UN chief warns that Israel's invasion of Rafah City would put the final nail in the coffin of aid programs to the Gaza Strip. Thanks for joining us. In Gaza, it's day 144 of Israel's onslaught, which has left a trail of death and destruction. Israeli forces' live fire has killed at least a dozen Palestinian civilians, including four people waiting for aid west of Gaza City. Scores of civilians were also killed and wounded in an Israeli drone strike in the central Nusayrat camp. To the south, in Rafah, at least three people, including a woman and a child, were killed in an airstrike that targeted a home. Gaza officials also say the attacks have destroyed the Strip's computing, communications, and control system. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society has announced a complete suspension of its medical missions in Gaza for 48 hours. The PRCS said Israel has failed to ensure the safety of its crews and the wounded. U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed hope that a ceasefire will be established in the Gaza Strip by next Monday amid reports of progress in talks between negotiators in the Qatari capital.
At least my national security advisor tells me that we're close. We're close. It's not done yet. And my hope is by next Monday, we'll have a ceasefire.
Biden's comments come a day after the White House national security advisor confirmed that negotiators are close to reaching a ceasefire deal. Doha is hosting a new round of talks with the presence of representatives from Israel, Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. According to media reports, Hamas resistance movement has received a draft proposal which allows for a 40-day initial halt in all military operations in Gaza. The pause would allow the release of 40 Israeli captives in exchange for 400 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. It also includes the return of displaced Palestinians to northern Gaza, as well as the entry of 8 trucks to the besieged territory. The regime is under pressure, including from its allies, to stop its genocidal campaign in Gaza, which has claimed nearly 29,800 lives so far. Muti Abu Musaba is our correspondent, joining us from Deir al-Balah to give us the latest in the Gaza Strip. Muti, what do you have for us?
Well, another appalling massacre committed yesterday after the Israeli occupation forces targeted a residential building in Rafah City, particularly in the surrounding area of Al Kuwait Hospital. In addition to that, over the last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces renewed their strikes against the same city. Another residential building was destroyed in Rafah City as well. These airstrikes actually were expanded to reach the central area and elsewhere in Gaza Strip. In the central area, over the last night, the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building in Deir al-Balah City in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. A multi-floor building was destroyed over those attacks and over those airstrikes. Dozens of the Palestinian casualties were reported to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery renewed and resumed their attacks against Al-Nusrat refugee camp, particularly Johr al-Dik neighborhood and Al-Mughraqa neighborhood. In the meantime, the Gaza Strip, Gaza City, and multiple neighborhoods in Gaza City were under heavy bombardments of the Israeli airstrikes and the continuous Israeli shelling of the Israeli tanks and the Israeli artillery. Ashat refugee camp, Zaytun neighborhood, Al-Tufah neighborhood, and Al-Daraj neighborhood, they were completely under heavy bombardment. Several Israeli airstrikes were waged and launched against those areas, destroying several and dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings there, and leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties. They were brought to the Al-Shifa medical complex amid the continuous attack and the relentless Israeli airstrikes and incursions waged against the Zaytun neighborhood. Massive destruction actually left behind those continuous attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. And despite all of that attack and despite all of that brutality and the destruction, the Palestinian resistance continued its fighting back against the Israeli occupation forces. They have announced that they have engaged in several clashes and gunfights with the Israeli occupation forces on the ground there. In addition to that, several mortar projectiles were fired to the Israeli occupation forces mobilized in the eastern parts of Gaza City. We can say that, according to the latest news, that the Palestinian resistance actually...
Looks like he got cut off, although we did have his voice. Okay. Got somewhat of an idea as to what is going on there in the Gaza Strip. And obviously the... death toll keeps mounting, even though there's talks of a ceasefire that may be coming to reach some kind of a stage here. If we have lost Muti Abu Musaba, then let's move on with the news. Yeah, we have lost them. All right, moving on. As an Israeli invasion of Gaza's southern city of Rafah looms larger, international warnings of its consequences grow louder and more ominous. Now the UN chief says any such offensive would completely end the UN's assistance programs in the besieged strip.
Rafah is the core of the humanitarian aid operation, and UNRWA is the backbone of that effort. An all-out Israeli offensive on the city would not only be terrifying for more than a million Palestinian civilians sheltering there, it would put the final nail in the coffin of our aid programs.
Speaking before the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Guterres said even now humanitarian aid in Gaza is completely insufficient. He added that international humanitarian law remains under attack in Gaza and repeated his calls for a ceasefire. The UN chief said the catastrophic situation in Gaza also shows the ineffectiveness of the Security Council and underlines the need for serious reforms to its composition and working methods. Guterres stressed that the Council's lack of unity on Israel's onslaught on Gaza has, in his words, severely or perhaps even fatally undermined his authority. The top UN court has wrapped up public hearings on Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian territories. Most participant nations and organizations have strongly condemned the brutal policies and practices carried out by Israel in the occupied Palestinian territories for over five decades. Max Civelli reports from The Hague.
On Monday, the Hague-based International Court of Justice heard the final day of submissions on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. Over the 6 days of the public hearings, 52 nations and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union presented their arguments to the court. The first to speak on the final day of the ICJ hearings was the Turkish representative who joined a large number of nations condemning Israel's decades-long brutal policies in the Palestinian territories. Ankara pointed the finger at those nations which won't stop supporting Tel Aviv despite 30,000 innocent people have been killed in the Gaza Strip.
Those who should do it are well known. The Israeli supporters in the Security Council, it is their responsibility. Indeed, most of the international community is aware of this injustice and is trying to do something.
Palestinian representatives opened the proceedings on Monday last week by accusing Israel of having subjected Palestinians to decades of discrimination, leaving them with the choice of displacement, subjugation, or death. 2 days later, the UK asked the court not to offer an opinion at all on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation.
Unfortunately, the UK came with the political arguments, and here we are in a legal body. Unfortunately, their legal argument was very weak, and we believe that the court will dismiss it. The Israeli practices and measures and its presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and unlawfulness should have consequences.
This ICJ case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, and it is different from another ICJ case filed by South Africa, which has accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Outside the court, activists showed their support to besieged Palestinians during all days of proceedings.
There's also not an excuse for the other countries to say, well, we are not complying with this legal system that we all agreed upon.
I'm here to just show the support, to say to the whole world that the genocide should stop. And this is the only way, actually, to support our people in Palestine and Gaza.
The court is expected to issue its advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories within 6 months. Despite having no binding force, the court's opinions nevertheless carry great legal weight and moral authority. However, it must be said, the ICJ has no enforcement arm. Max Civili, The Hague.
A U.S. service member has set himself on fire outside of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., in protest against 143 days of the regime's genocide in the Gaza Strip. Quick caution, viewer discretion is advised on the following images.
I am an active duty member of the United States Air Force, and I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest, but compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal.
The video of the incident was posted on an American video streaming service. The incident lasted about a minute before law enforcement officers extinguished the flames. The man was on active duty or an active duty member of the U.S. Air Force. The Pentagon has confirmed that he has died. This is the second incident of its kind outside of an Israeli facility in the U.S. since the start of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Last week, the U.S. used its veto power for a third time to block a U.N. resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has fired dozens of rockets at an Israeli military base located in the northern occupied Palestinian territories. Hezbollah said in a statement that it targeted an aerial surveillance base in the Upper Galilee region with 40 rockets. It said the attack was in response to Monday's Israeli strike on the Lebanese city of Baalbek that left 2 civilians dead. On Monday, the resistance group also shot down an Israeli drone over southern Lebanon. Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in clashes since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Lebanese resistance fighters have mainly targeted Israeli military positions, but the Israeli regime has even targeted residential areas in Lebanon, causing the death of civilians. 3 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli raids near the occupied West Bank of Nablus. A funeral has been held for one of the victims who was killed in the town of Tubas. The slain Palestinian was a member of the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement. Palestinians have announced a general strike in protest against his killing. The two other Palestinians were killed in Al-Far refugee camp near Tubas. Since October the 7th, Israeli forces and settlers have stepped up their attacks against Palestinians across the occupied territories. In its latest report, the UN said around 400 Palestinians, including at least 100 children, have been killed since then. Correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us with more details about the latest Israeli deadly raids on the West Bank.
The Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Al-Far'a and Tamun as well, Al-Far'a in Tubas, and heavy clashes have taken place between Palestinian members of the resistance groups and the Israeli forces. During this military raid that continued for several hours, the Israeli forces assassinated the three Palestinians. Why we are saying assassinated? Because the Israeli military just issued a statement saying they succeeded to kill the leader of Tubas battalion, Mohammed Bayatsi. This battalion that is part of the Saraya al-Quds, the armed wing of the Jihad movement here in the occupied West Bank. And Bayatsi was also killed with two other Palestinians during this operation. The Israeli military also said they carried out a military operation elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, in Jenin, in Ramallah, in Ariha, as well as in Nablus. Here in Ramallah, the Israelis stormed the Al-Jalazon refugee camp and detained at least two Palestinians.
Mass organized protests have not been the only way of expressing support for Palestinians and drawing attention to their plight. In the Austrian capital, Vienna, pro-Palestinian activists are trying other initiatives to spread their message, namely flash mobs. Several such flash mobs have been held in Vienna over the past week. The venues include train stations, malls, and theaters. The participants say this means of protest is quick and easy to organize and also more effective than the traditional methods of demonstrations. They say that it puts pressure on the people and the government to take action. We've been speaking to some of them.
The Austrian government makes itself accomplice in genocide, ignoring Austrians' neutrality, which is would be mean to demand a just peace and negotiations on eyesight. Therefore, we must keep the pressure on the public and on the government and on the police forces high, even in the face of repression, which we are facing here now in Austria, and must organize decentralized actions and gatherings and flash mobs to mobilize the public and to keep the topic in the minds and the heads of the people and to keep the pressure up.
The Austrian government, they don't say anything. The Austrian government is not doing anything. The Austrian government is voting three times against the ceasefire. Today we had this action at the mall because we just see that demonstrating is not enough. And in the mall we just want to spread awareness to the people, that the people in Gaza, they are starving, they don't have food, they don't have water, they don't have anything, no medicine, nothing. So we really want to spread more awareness to the people on the street. That's why some small actions, flash mobs like that are really, really important also to inform the people.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups, neglecting that this would reinforce the dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddy was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Kedi highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American University lecturer Yervant Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Halliday. John Foran from the University of California in Santa Barbara focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Halliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development. Like others too, he too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Halliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Halliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda selfies. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. In February, the Islamic world marks the 59th anniversary of the assassination of the Muslim activist, thinker and revolutionary, known most popularly as Malcolm X. This week's episode will explore the life of Malcolm, later known as Al-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, and his contributions to raising the revolutionary awareness of black people in America, encouraging them to embrace Islam and reject degeneracy, and his efforts to build solidarity across anti-imperialist movements in the global south. First, let's take a closer look into the background of the man himself, Malcolm X.
Born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska on May 19, 1925, Malcolm X was the son of Earl and Louise Helen Little, and he was the fourth child of their seven children. Malcolm's father, Earl, was a local civil rights activist advocating for America's long-oppressed African-American people. When Malcolm was just an infant, the family were forced to relocate to Michigan due to threats from the Ku Klux Klan in Nebraska. In Michigan, the family were also subjected to terror and violence by white supremacist groups, and when Malcolm was just four, the family home was burnt down. When Malcolm turned six, his father died in what was officially ruled a streetcar accident, though his mother Louise believed Earl had been murdered by racist white militants. After several years of trying to raise seven kids on her own, and with a meager income and her own mental health struggles finally taking its toll, Louise had a mental breakdown, and all seven of her children were divided and sent to foster homes across the country. Malcolm spent his adolescence being sent to several foster homes and was drawn into a life of crime. He had stated his intention to be a lawyer, but was discouraged after a racist schoolteacher told him he wouldn't amount to anything. Eventually, Malcolm found himself in prison in his early 20s, sentenced to 8 to 10 years for larceny and breaking and entering. And it was in prison where Malcolm underwent a total transformation of character, reading heavily about the tribulations faced by America's black people, stopping smoking and the eating of pork, and then embracing Islam. He became enamored with the teachings of the Nation of Islam and dropped his surname, henceforth being known simply as Malcolm X. After he emerged from prison in 1952, Malcolm was a rising star in the nation and quickly cemented himself as one of the movement's most electrifying and important figures. At this point, he had garnered the attention of the FBI and numerous police departments, all of whom had placed Malcolm under surveillance. But this had no effect on Malcolm, as his infectious personality continued to attract converts to both Islam as a religion and to the Nation of Islam as a movement. Malcolm grew to prominence not only as a community leader, but on the international stage, where he built links with African liberation movements, international politicians, and held audiences with anti-imperialist revolutionary leaders like Fidel Castro, Gamal Abdel Nasser, and Kwame Nkrumah. Tragically, Malcolm, whose name at this point was Alhaj Malik al-Shabazz, was to be martyred in 1965 at the young age of 39 after being shot at the Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan, New York, just as he was about to give a speech. Much speculation remains to this day as to the real perpetrators of his murder, but many point the finger at the agencies of the US regime, in particular the FBI and the NYPD, who were surveilling, threatening, and harassing Malcolm to increasingly intense degrees. But while the man may have been murdered, his ideas, his charismatic personality, and his unwavering support for liberation movements from America to Africa to Asia continue to outlive him and inspire millions to this day.
Now, joining us on the show this week to discuss this historic personality and movement are two very special guests. Firstly, I'm joined by Dr. Musa Ibrahim, the coordinator of the African Legacy Forum Johannesburg. Dr. Musa is a Pan-Africanist, author, and a media and political activist based in Africa. And we're also honoured to be joined by Mizanur Rahman, also known as Mizan the Poet, a British Bengali campaigner and anti-racist activist who specialises in disentangling and disseminating the processes and policies used against oppressed communities in the UK through workshops and articles. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you both. If I could begin here with yourself, brother Mizan. We just learnt a little bit there about the life of brother Malcolm X. Could we begin by asking you on a personal level what he means to you and how he's inspired you in your worldview?
SubhanAllah. Malcolm, you know, my whole political activism is down to Malcolm X. I remember in my university years, I was going through a transition of disillusionment, and I was particularly unhappy and disillusioned with the political world and the education system as a whole, and I was looking for some sort of guidance, spiritual, moral, and philosophical. And I remember reading Malcolm's biography, and I'm thinking, before I read it, I thought to myself, what can I learn from his life? And to be honest with you, Malcolm was where a lot of us want to be. So when I read the autobiography, I understood him more him as a person. And he helped me develop my political activism in terms of how he was, how he engaged with politics and religion. That's the type of framework that I try to use and engage with myself. So for me, Malcolm was, you know, he's the primary inspiration between my in regards to my Muslim identity and also my political identity as well.
Absolutely. And if I could just ask the same question to yourself, Dr. Musa, again, what brother Malcolm means to you on a personal level and how he's also inspired your worldview and your activism.
Bismillah. When I was 12 years old in 1986, the United States of America, assisted by the UK, attacked my home country of Libya, sending bombs and rockets on the two big cities of the country, Benghazi and Tripoli, killing dozens of children, women, and men. I remember the following day at my local school, our teacher came in the class, talked about the empire, the evil American empire, and how we must fight against it. And then he mentioned our brothers from within the belly of the beast, so to speak, fighting with us to dismantle this evil entity we call American capitalism. And the name he mentioned with a picture was Malcolm X. He said, kids, look at this face and remember this name. This is a brother from Africa who the circumstances led his ancestors to be captured, enslaved in the New World. And he fought for freedom, for justice, and he fought for the unity between brothers and sisters from the global South everywhere. Since then, I have always been inspired by the face and the name and the work of Malcolm X. And every time I read of him, I read about him, I read his work and listened to his voice, I always understood that this man was a true revolutionary who is able to mobilize hearts and minds until this day. So Malcolm X is a personal hero of mine, and he is for me a true inspiration. Every time I feel down, I feel weakened, I feel I need spiritual or intellectual help indeed, I resort to him, I come back to him.
Just to stay with yourself, Dr. Musa, you've spoken so eloquently there about Brother Malcolm and what he means to yourself and so many people, but he also took a particularly uncompromising view on liberals and their fake solidarity with the black community in America. Are there any lessons that apply to today also?
Oh, absolutely. There is something we need to remember. We should never put Brother Malcolm in a kind of nostalgic, romantic light. What he did the best for me was his praxis. He evolved throughout the years because he was engaged on a daily level with the issues of the revolution and the people, the oppressed people he wanted to help out. So he did not sit in his home or flat thinking and contemplating. He went out and he fought. And as he did that, he developed, he changed, he understood more. So when he started, he was a little bit, you know, in a narrow space, in a narrow thinking methodology. But as he got to know people, as he traveled, as he came to Africa, as he met with the great leaders of African liberation, Arab liberation, as he engaged with his brothers and sisters in the United States and abroad, he changed his ideas. He made them stronger. He understood the true nature of the fight, and he became an international icon. And this is my advice for myself and for everyone fighting for freedom and liberation. Do not sit on your fixed ideas. Always engage with other people. Go out and practice what you preach. And prepare yourself to change and to evolve, because the beast is always evolving. The beast is always changing forms. So we need to stand tall and become intellectually open, emotionally open, and come to new forms of resistance. These could be artistic forms of resistance, political, on the ground, sometimes militant. And this is exactly the main lesson to take from Malcolm, I think.
Thank you so much, Dr. Musa, for such an in-depth answer there. And Brother Mizar, if I can come back to you just quickly before we move to the next section. How did Brother Malcolm's religious beliefs develop over time? You know, what stances did he take in terms of his politicized Islamic practice, maybe, that, again, are relevant for us today?
It's very important. So, you know, there are different phases of Malcolm's life, and in each phase there was a different, you know, he had a different view on religion. So before he became a member of the Nation of Islam, when he was known as Malcolm Little, he had a very antagonistic view towards religion. He basically, in his biographies and other books written about him, he basically hated religion, even though he comes from a tradition and his parents were very religious Christian people. And also, they were also, you know, they were also anti-racist in their time as well, you know, following the teachings of Marcus Garvey and, you know, other people like W.E.B. Du Bois and other people. Even though Malcolm hated religion, he had that teaching within him, instilled within him from his parents, especially when it comes to black liberation. So that was the first phase. So when he was Malcolm Little doing all the crime and stuff, he was also known as Satan because he hated religion. He used to disparage religion so much. However, when he went into prison, and he was introduced to the concepts of the Nation of Islam, it wasn't really the religious practices, from my understanding, that really drew him in. What drew him in was the essence of reformation, of becoming better. So that's the other phase where he actually started to change his view on religion in terms of when it came to the practices of the Nation of Islam and its distorted view as taught by Ford Muhammad. So again, that was another change where he saw himself become a religious person, but not just a religious person, but a person who intertwined, who infused concepts of black liberation and religion together, because he saw reformation as part and parcel of liberation as well at the same time. So that was the other phase. And then when he became El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, basically, that was another phase where he understood Islam better. He started practicing the normative practices of Islam and again became more internationalist. I would say the thing that kind of intertwines both phases, his NOI phase and his Sunni Muslim phase, is that he learnt Islam from what he understands Islam to be. He learnt it and he taught it. He had specific sheikhs. When he became a Sunni Muslim, he went to the Islamic Center of Geneva and he spent a couple of months with Tariq Ramadan's dad, learning Orthodox Islam and understanding how to entwine politics and Islam together.
And what's interesting is, Dr. Musa was saying, he was constantly learning. He wasn't resting on his laurels. Now, of course, Shaheed Malcolm X was also known for joining the Black Liberation Movement with the global fight against colonialism and imperialism. We can take a look now at how this came about.
Malcolm X.
In 1964, Malcolm X's trip to North Africa and the Middle East brought him to Palestine, to the heart of the Arab liberation struggle. Spending a few days in Gaza, hosted by government officials and Palestinian poet Harun Hashim Rashid, he visited local institutions, hospitals, and the Khan Yunis refugee camp, where he bore witness to the everyday struggles of life under occupation. Soon after, he would pen his letter published in the Egyptian Gazette titled Zionist Logic, which confirmed the deeply transformative impact this trip had on his ideology and worldview. Here, he outlined the key issues with the Zionist movement, which still stand today, including the problems with its religious claim to the land and its colonial roots, by describing the movement as a new, well-disguised extension of European imperialism. He encouraged African nations to wake up to the realities of this new form of colonialism and to stand firm in support of the Palestinian struggle. Historically, the Black and Palestinian liberation movements have always been deeply intertwined. Malcolm X was one of the first many engaged in the civil rights movement of the 60s, like the Black Panther Party, that went on to meet with and recognize the Palestinian Liberation Organization after its creation in 1964, marking one of the first attempts to centralize resistance and guerrilla efforts against the Israeli occupation. Almost always, it was those considered within the more radical fringes of the Black Liberation Movement who drew a direct parallel between the quest for African-American freedom and global anti-colonial movements, especially within the Arab world, in order to build transnational solidarity and a holistic understanding of liberation. Malcolm X's vision in particular set a new standard for acceptable resistance outside the framework of nonviolence, which deemed any armed struggle as illegitimate purely because of its methods. Even today, there are those who claim to seek self-determination for the Palestinian people, whilst openly denying the right to grassroots resistance like Mahmoud Abbas, the current leader of the Palestinian Authority. Since its instatement under the Oslo Accords, the PA has progressively become an extension of the Israeli entity, with many Palestinians themselves holding it accountable for prolonging the status quo that enables the occupation. The reality has ignited ever-growing support for the Palestinian resistance movement, which is an embodiment of Malcolm X's revolutionary vision, that is to attain freedom by any means necessary. With its rise, Malcolm X's worldview has once again been brought to life, cementing the importance of armed resistance.
Now, Dr. Musa, if I can come back to you, I guess, you know, we've seen the role that faith has played in the life of Malcolm in reforming him as a personality, in prison, of course. But what role does it play in liberation movements like that we've seen going on right now in Gaza, where the Palestinian people are really leaning into their faith in order to, you know, overcome and be steadfast during this time of great tribulation?
It's very sad that even now in the year 2024, there are good people fighting for justice, for liberation, who still import revolutionary ideas from outside of their culture. Mostly they would become Eurocentric in their outlook, and they believe in a system of values that is foreign to the very society and the very people they are claiming, they claim they are helping to liberate. This is a major mistake, and the life and work of Malcolm X help us to see that clearly. If one wants to help their people to move forward and to stand tall against oppression, then they must engage with the value system, with the religion, the culture, the history of those people. So for me, this is my advice to every young man and woman coming up and trying to open a new way for justice, whether it's economic justice, cultural justice, political justice. Do not separate yourself. Look at what Malcolm did. Malcolm went on the streets, went to the universities, colleges, schools. He talked to everyday people, and he understood that their pain is intertwined with their spirit, with the way they saw the world. If you do not interact with that, then you will be seen as a foreigner. You will be seen as someone who is a stranger to the not just the feelings, the emotions of the people, but to their interests, their economic interests, political interests. So spirituality is not something to indulge with or indulge in. Spirituality is a true, genuine weapon of change. Spirituality helps us to gather people around the cause and to ease their pain, but not to make them forget the pain. And within every religion, in Islam, for example, yes, some people might find some reactionary elements that do not fit, if you like, the needs of the revolution. But a great religion like Islam has many revolutionary, progressive elements that call for justice, call for change. And the genuine revolutionary, man or woman, can indeed build on the great history of Islam, the great heroes of Islam, to bridge any gap with people and to actually unite people from different colors, different backgrounds, and give them that hope, true hope, not false, because, of course, as you know, brother, the system of oppression is very good at producing false hopes. But the hope that people get from the history of their culture, of their religion, can be a powerful, real, genuine weapon to unite people, make them stand the pain of this very oppressive system and move forward. And Malcolm did that in many beautiful ways. He started with his very narrow vision of religion, and then he enlarged this vision and made it truly revolutionary and truly uniting for the people.
Absolutely, Doctor, and really incredible there to hear such an eloquent answer that touched on so many things, and particularly that unity of causes, which leads us perfectly to what I wanted to ask you, which was, you know, Malcolm lent into this concept of internationalism. We heard earlier him his trips to Africa and really trying to marry those struggles in Africa, in Palestine, with the struggles domestically in the US. What can we today learn about that and applying those internationalist principles?
I think it's very important to understand that, especially when it comes to Malcolm's upbringing, because his parents were Garveyites. They had that kind of internationalist leaning anyway. So Malcolm kind of absorbed that and basically amplified that aspect of his childhood and of his learning, of his upbringing. Now, Malcolm never stopped learning. He never stopped observing the world. And as Dr. Musa said, he was always a learner. He would always interact. And one of the things that, you know, we have to understand is that his political ideas were always evolving as well at the same time. So if you read Lee and Tamara Payne's book, The Dead Are Arising, they interviewed people who knew Malcolm, who said that by the time when he became Alhaj Malik Shabazz, he started adopting a more socialist understanding of politics and the system today, and internationalism as well. So I think his understanding of how the political system works was always evolving, or he was always learning. But I think there's one key concept that is that we have to understand, and that as people who are engaged politically, we have to try and absorb as well. Because when he went to talk to the United Nations, when he went to talk to heads of state, when he went to talk to important people, he always said that I'm here on behalf of the 22 million black people in America. He always situated himself with the oppressed class, with his people. He never forgot where he was from. Wherever he was, he always situated himself as part of the oppressed class. Whereas nowadays, we have leaders from our community that don't really situate themselves from where we are. They situate themselves from a class level where they see themselves as above. Malcolm never saw himself as above. He saw himself as part of the people he was representing. And I think that is very important, and that is something we must imbue within ourselves as well.
And I think it's interesting as well, we've seen in this latest genocide against the Palestinian people, yeah, a similar type of internationalism. You know, you've seen brothers coming together from Lebanon, from Yemen, from Iraq, from Iran, from other countries, different religious views or different worldviews, and yet they've all built this sort of axis which leans into that. And it's important that people understand that it's not a nationalist struggle, it's a global,
struggle
that crosses these boundaries. Yeah. Brother Mizano, I think we could chat about this for hours. I know we could with Dr. Musa as well. It's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, and thank you as well at home. You can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum. We'll be right back.